Welcome to the Junior NBA Coach's Corner. Here are your hosts, Dallin Cuff and Monica McNutt.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to season three of the Junior NBA Coach's Corner podcast alongside the one, the only, the amazingly talented Monica McNutt. I'm Dallin Cuff. Mon, season three, ready to roll.
We are back, my guy. Apparently, we did a decent enough job last year. They invited us back for more shenanigans.
just barely. But I'm glad we're back in the seats. A lot of great guests coming up over the next few months. Most of the year, I should say, get into a lot of different topics on the court, off the court. Today, though, we're going to talk about, discuss some NBA African-American pioneers, obviously MLK Day coming up here. So much the league is doing. We've got great games. But to celebrate this, or to talk about this, we're going to have Chuck Cooper III on. And Chuck Cooper, his father, Chuck Cooper Jr., was the first Black player ever drafted in the NBA back in 1951 to the Celtics. Had a great career. And I think this conversation with Chuck is interesting just because, as we'll allude to get to, somehow a lot of people don't know the story. Well, now, mm-hmm. which is, you know, everybody knows Jackie Robinson. Everybody seems to think about Bill Russell and how instrumental he was in the NBA. But there were guys before Bill Russell who he's aware of, but I feel like society and a lot of players are not aware of.
Yeah, I'm so excited. And not only are we going to talk about just the basketball piece and how good Chuck Cooper Jr. was, but just the arc of his life. And I think sometimes mm-hmm. when we look at progress or look back at history and compare it to progress, we don't realize all that went into it. So I'm mm-hmm. really looking forward to this conversation with CC3 as he goes by on his email signatures and such.
Yeah, and we'll talk about too that not just the on the court stuff, but the mental struggle that these men went through. And it wasn't just his father, as he outlined, but his father was the first drafted. I just can't imagine that. And there's so many things when I look back through our history that I can't imagine managing that process physically, mentally, emotionally. And they did it every day and did it at such a level that allowed those others to come after and be able to play in the league because they were so exceptional on and off the court.
Yeah, Cuff. And you and I know that like a huge part of the team sport experience is the team. Like to the detail of being fractured within your team because of the color of your skin, like that robs you of, to me, one of the biggest components of the team experience in terms of that camaraderie and just being able to kick it and not just compete together.
Yeah, it's fascinating to say the least. It's educational. It's painful when you think about what went on in the past, but we're still trying to make progress today. But what those men and women dealt with years and years ago is mind-boggling. So without further ado, let's get to Chuck Cooper III. Chuck, thank you so much for your time. We're excited to be chatting with you. Obviously, a very important time on our calendar, very important time in our society, and a very relevant time to have this discussion with you about what you're doing in the foundation, but also your father. I kind of want to start there. My father played at Duquesne as well in the mid-60s, a basketball player. So I actually knew your father's story. Go Dukes. One of the few stories that I remembered as a young kid, him telling me this story, how important it was. So what I want to ask you is, how did you come about learning your story? Was it your father that explained it, or was it family? How did you start to understand what your father did and what he represented to so many folks?
Well, I was the only son. I had three sisters. So for me, you know, I wanted to follow my father's footsteps. I loved the game of basketball myself. And, you know, he would have, you know, some trophies and stuff around the house when I was at a very young age, and I would ask him about it. But I don't think it was probably until high school that I realized the importance and the significance of the barrier that he broke. And it wasn't until, you know, 2020 when, you know, I released the Chuck Cooper book, Breaking Barriers, that I realized, you know, just how good a player he was and how much he was on the national radar. I mean, he had after his junior year at Duquesne, he was had contract offers from Chicago, New York, the Harlem Globetrotters, and so he, you know, he could play. And as I reflect and look back on just not my dad, but all the early African American pioneers, the one thing they don't get credit for is just how good of players they were. They were great athletes. So hopefully, at some point in this interview, we could take a little deeper dive into that.
I'm all for it, Chuck. We certainly would love to get into that. But it's interesting that you said it wasn't until high school that it kind of landed on you in terms of all that your dad did. What kind of conversations? Like, was he the guy that was, I'm doing this because I'm a man, I deserve these opportunities, I'm talented? Or was he focused on breaking these barriers? I mean, I'm always curious about how that comes to be in terms of folks' identity and the legacy that they leave.
That's a great question, Monica. And he was focused on, you know, breaking barriers for his race. And my dad, Earl Lloyd, Sweetwater Clifton, collectively, none of them wanted to do anything while they were in the league that would mess up opportunities for those coming behind them. And they successfully accomplished that. But with my father's case, I mean, he continued to break barriers after basketball. You know, education, he got his master's degree in 1960, at a time where very few African-Americans were getting master's degrees. And, you know, he became the first African-American city department director in the city of Pittsburgh history. So he broke barriers. And you know, he also became one of the first black executives at Pittsburgh National Bank. When we interviewed one of their CEOs, former CEOs, he said, you know, the thing about Chuck Cooper was, you know, it was never about him. It was always about, you know, other people. And that's how he lived, to the point that sometimes I think we felt cheated a little bit as a family. And he was a great father and a great family guy, but we realized that we had to share him with the Pittsburgh community.
Which is, I can imagine, difficult for you and your siblings, but obviously sure. benefiting the greater society was what was intrinsic to him. You mentioned this, though, too, and obviously Sidney Poitier just passed away, an absolute legend, and he had a quote saying that every move he made, he thought he was representing 15 to 18 million black people in our country. Right. And your father, obviously, when you mentioned Sweetwater Clifton, those guys were pioneers. Jackie Robinson has talked about it. How much, if at all, did your father discuss that pressure, that it's not just you doing your job, it's you doing your job representing so many at a time when there was no representation? How did he manage that pressure?
You know, it was tough. It was tough for him. And, you know, you mentioned Jackie Robinson. And, you know, when people ask me questions like, how was your dad's experience similar to Jackie's? You know, one thing I'll point out is in Earl and Sweetwater, I'm sure would agree. I've got a chance to, you know, talk to the late, great Mr. Earl Lloyd. So I've heard him say this, you know, himself. But, you know, with Jackie's experience, he didn't get support from his teammates. Right. But with my dad, Sweetwater, Earl, at bare minimum, you know, the organizations made sure that they all were treated with dignity and respect. But also, on the flip side of that, you know, baseball is an individual enough sport that, you know, you had to pitch to Jackie, right? So Jackie got a chance to do his thing, especially if the bases were loaded. You had to throw Jackie that fastball, and he'd take it out the park, right? And then when Jackie got on base, his athleticism and his speed was, you know, he used to steal home at a time when hardly nobody else was doing it, right? But in basketball, it's different. You know, the early African pioneers, African-American pioneers, like my dad, Earl Lloyd, Don Barksdale, who was a great, great player, the first African-American Olympian, you know, they were expected to rebound and play defense and do the dirty work. And in some cases, even, you know, almost be protectors of the white stars on their teams. Matter of fact, they had a pact that, listen, one thing we will not do is go against each other. So, you know, I just wish that you know, as we reflect and look at history, you know, and as we continue to talk about these guys, that if anything, you know, I want to make sure that people really get an understanding and appreciation just how good they were. They were great players.
All right. So to that end, Chuck, so we had the little Antonio Brown saga, slight segue. But the one thing that he did say over the course of the saga that I'm curious about is that he and Tom Brady wouldn't be friends if he wasn't so good at basketball, right? And so I wonder, I mean, there's the great line from the book about leadership at Boston being told that your dad was a black guy when they wanted to draft him. And the response was, I don't care if he's black, white, plaid, or polka dot, like that's who we're drafting. But it is certainly, honestly, Chuck, like it's certainly a transactional relationship. So it behooved those teams in Boston to support your dad. But then he talks about later on, under Red Holtzman, it wasn't quite the same sort of support. And so I just wonder, had your dad ever spoke on, or did you observe how much of the transactional nature of this support came into play? Or did these teammates grow to support your dad as a black man who represented a huge historic figure? And then even furthermore, the movement in terms of the changes that needed to be made in our society.
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think they looked at it in quite that bigger picture. You know, number one, basketball wasn't the major sport at that time. It was baseball. Mm. And, you know, I'm sure there was some resentment of him breaking that barrier and being on the team. But The Celtics ownership and their coach Red Auerbach and their owner Walter Brown just wouldn't let them treat my dad with anything but dignity and respect. And you mentioned Red Holtzman, you know, when he had that incident, you know, when he was playing with them, you know, they had went down to Baton Rouge, Louisiana to play a game. And there were 7,000 people at the game. And basically Red Holtzman asked my dad, you know, what do you think we should do? And he's like, look, if you're asking me that question, you're not serious about it. There's no way you're going to cancel this game with 7,000 people in the stands. So, you know, I think that I really got to give, you know, the Boston Celtics organization credit. When you look at the culture of the Celtics, and even today, I'm on the Celtics United for Social Justice Initiative, where they're, you know, pouring $25 million into the Boston community to fight racial injustice. You know, it's just a great organization. I mean, they drafted my father as the first, which broke that barrier. You know, there was no other official act happened before my father was drafted by the Boston Celtics. He started. Earl Lloyd was the first to play. My dad was the first to ever start an NBA game. He started from day one. Then Boston started the first black starting five. They had the first black head coach. So in the case of the Celtics, I really just think it was you know, they realized how important it was to do the right thing. And you know, I tell people all the time, you know, when I speak to people, sometimes when you do the right thing, great things happen. And I think that's really plays well with the fact that they have 17, you know, world championships, because they're an organization that believes on making the right decisions based on the right reasons.
It's interesting you say that, but you also just made the point before, you want people to know how good your father was, the other players, how good they were. So they were doing the right things.
Hello?
But in the essence to win, though. I mean, they absolutely were doing the right things by society, but they wanted to win. I mean, Jackie Robinson was the AL or the NL Rookie of the Year. Your dad was, there were all-star teams for these guys. Like, it was about doing the right thing, but also was about winning. So let me ask you this then, because your dad now is where he should be, enshrined in the Hall of Fame. These stories about our pioneers are becoming more commonly told, not to folks who just grew up, you know, with an alum in the house, but to other people are telling these stories. But to you, it does matter that we know that they were good. Why is that important?
Because it's true.
If
people don't know, you know, my dad was a consensus All-American. He set Duquesne's scoring record his junior year, right? Sweetwater Clifton, check this out. A lot of people don't know this. He actually played professional Negro League baseball at the same time he was playing for the Knicks. Both Sweetwater and my dad continued to tour with the Globetrotters. My dad was on the contract with the Globetrotters first, even before the Celtics drafted him. But, you know, and my dad was named to the All-Rookie team. It wasn't an official NBA team at that time, but it was based on the Basketball Writers of America. And, you know, when you look at the highlights of my dad playing, I always like to point out to people, you know, we hear about Connie Hawk and Dr. J, but my dad's finger rolling, he's crossing over, you know what I mean? He's touch passing. His game was built a little bit different than the style of ball they were playing back then. And I remember him telling me stories about Sweetwater and just how great he was, or Earl. They call Earl the moon fixer. So these guys, they brought another level of athleticism to the league. And also my dad's style of play wasn't, you know, they were still kind of passing the ball around the perimeter. My dad was 6'5", you know, about 210. And he could go, you know, he was a slasher. He can handle, he had an all around game, and the style of offenses that they played back then, you know, didn't support that skill set. So, you know, he probably would have did better if he was playing in today's times. So, but no, these guys were just, you know, they were tremendous players. They were great people. And, you know, a lot of times when you look back and, you know, even when my dad got in the Hall of Fame, I saw, you know, some social media posts like, oh, he only averaged, you know, 7 points a game. Yeah, but I mean, they didn't pass him the rock. Mm-hmm. He had to get garbage buckets, you know what I mean? So he wasn't featured in the offense. So it's just a shame that, you know, because these stories are told so little, and people look at numbers now, but you know, today's games is just number driven, right? Mm-hmm. So they look at the numbers and they think they were marginal players, and that definitely wasn't the case. These guys could play.
First off, Chuck, you messed up by going on social media checking for like them clowns don't know.
Nowadays,
they don't know nothing. But I love that you pointed that out. I mean, even as we prep for this, I didn't realize that at one point the whole Harlem Globetrotters were legit, like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Hoopers, yeah. Guys that were really talented, mm-hmm. And that was an honor as opposed to and one before and one, like the mixtape. I just think the history of the game is so cool. And I think having the opportunity to celebrate stories like this, it just reminds us of the power of sport in a way that I don't know that a fan thinks about when you just show up to an arena.
Right. And you mentioned the Globetrotters. So in 1947 and 1948, the Globetrotters played the Minneapolis Lakers, which they had George Mikan, which George Mikan was considered the Shaq of his day, right? And the Globetrotters beat them back-to-back years. So two things happened, right? The all-black team beat the all-white team, right? So they showed that these guys could play. But the other thing that would happen, and probably was more important, we talk about, you know, why did the game get integrated? Well, the NBA games back at that time, a good game might draw 3,000 to 5,000 people. When the Globetrotters played the Lakers and beat them back-to-back years, it was in Chicago, they drew over 20,000 people.
Oh, wow.
So when it makes dollars, it makes what? It makes sense. So not only did they prove they could play, they proved that the people would, you know, wanted to see them play. But yeah, those guys could play in the Harlem Globetrotters, you know, really helped to integrate the NBA.
The history of the Globetrotters, the Harlem Wrens, the New York Wrens, there's all those stories of those teams in the 30s and 40s that helped set the trend for how the league got integrated and given players a chance to shine when they didn't have that opportunity. As your father moved out of playing, we talked about his impact at the Pittsburgh National Bank, which became PNC, the Pittsburgh community. But in terms of him talking to you about the civil rights struggle through the 60s, what was his role, or what did he think his role was within that battle as more athletes were coming out, whether it was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar or Arthur Ashe or Muhammad Ali? There were other athletes that have been tied to that period of time. How did he fix into that, and how did he reflect on that years past?
Well, he certainly participated in the marches. He and my mother would go to the marches. And, you know, he was just incredibly proud of, you know, the players at the time that were, at this time, sports was getting big enough that people knew who Bill Russell was. They knew who Muhammad Ali was. Muhammad Ali was internationally known. Jim Brown was on the map. Mm-hmm. For these guys, and when you think about it, and this is why he really has so much in respect and appreciation for guys like Bill Russell and Elgin Baylor, who were the ones in the NBA who began to say, listen, we're not staying in separate hotels anymore. But all those guys that were involved in the movement, I mean, they were putting their athletic careers on the line. Now, at the time, they weren't making the kind of money that, you know, LeBron and these guys are making today. But still, it was a sacrifice. It was a bold move. So, you know, he supported the movement. He supported the marches in person, and he had a lot of respect, and he made sure that, you know, me and my sisters were educated on the movement and had an appreciation for the people that were, you know, and without a better way to put it, were putting their necks on the line.
Golly, it's so impressive when we think about how closely a passion in your livelihood is tied to history, right? Like, I mean, we all enjoy what we do, but And yes, we have platforms and you have the opportunity to point out injustices, but the weight of that, I mean, I just think the weight of it is so incredible. And your dad's arc, Chuck, when it's just not what he did in basketball, like he went on, we talk now about how many NBA players are active in their communities and in light of George Floyd and what we saw, but to move into that space with such enthusiasm and impact after his career, like I'm just so impressed. Like a man that could teach himself an instrument and another English, like a language, like my co-hosts, are just so incredible.
Well, you know, let me just touch on that a little bit. You just made me think of something. You know, it was an incredible sacrifice, though. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of his close friends, because my dad died at 57, and you know, mm-hmm. You look at a lot of these great players, Jackie Robinson. You know, these guys died early. And a couple of my dad's good friends told me, they said, listen, Chuck, part of what killed your father was stress. And it was the stress of being the first and carrying a burden and breaking barriers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and that's one reason why I think it's really important for, you know, today's players, and not just the players, but the league, the executives, you know, everybody who benefits from, to in my personal opinion, the greatest league in the world, should really, they owe these guys a gratitude, and we should continue to tell their stories. And we haven't yet fully told their stories, and we're forgetting about Earl and Chuck and Nat Sweetwater Clifton and Darn Barksdale, you know, those guys that paved the way and maybe to the point where they shaved some years off of their lives and breaking that barrier, dealing with that overt racism. Yeah. You know, not, you know, you think about players today, you know, they got these psychologists and motivational speakers come in. They couldn't even stay with their own team. Mm-hmm. They couldn't catch a cab ride and go see a movie with their friends on their team, right? You know, how do you experience that? And also just the Jim Crow laws in our country, mm-hmm. and still get out there and play on a professional level. Like, how do you do that, right? You know, players now, you know, we all have, you know, we talk about mental health and that sort of thing. Now it's popular, but imagine what these guys were going through, right?
Gosh.
Yeah. I can't. And these are also the same generation that went and fought a war to essentially save the world. So, I mean, this is your father involved in that as well. So it's like what that generation and these black men that came back and then tried to trailblaze. I mean, Jack Robinson, the same thing. He was enlisted in the Army, did the same, like, it's beyond just what they did on the court, obviously. Right. It's broader than that. In terms of that, do you, and when your dad got inducted to the Hall of Fame or enshrined on the stage, you have Dr. J, Larry Bird, Dominic Wilkins, you had all these great stars up there of the game.
Hold on, D. I love this question, but I want to go through the whole list because you and I are on the same page. But I do want our listeners to hear the list of guys that stood alongside you as your dad was being enshrined. And so the whole list: Julius Irving, Bill Russell, Larry Bird, Elgin Baylor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Isaiah Thomas, Dominic Wilkins, Bill Walton, Ray Allen, and Manny Jackson. Please continue, Dallin. Whew, what a list.
Listen,
go ahead, Chuck.
No, I was just going to say when they called me and told me, you know, who was going to present my dad, I'll be honest, I was headed to a meeting. I broke down and just cried. I still get emotional thinking about it. You know, for those guys, and the way the Hall of Fame works is you get a chance to ask, you know, who would present, right? And I wanted to do a couple of things when I asked, you know, these greatest, some of the Mount Rushmore of the Hall of Fame to present my father. They all had to have some type of connection, either play for the Celtics. My dad also played for the Pistons and the Hawks. So you got Isaiah and Dominique in there, or just players that I remember hearing him talk about that he had a lot of respect for, like, again, Elgin Baylor and Bill Russell for, you know, beginning to take that stance and making sure that there was equality in how they traveled and how they were treated in the league. You know, the Manny Jackson, you know, owner of the Globetrotters at one time, great player. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they were all connected to my father. But when I heard, you know, who accepted and they were going to present my dad, because you got to think about it. For Kareem, you know, it's not easy for him to get on a plane. I don't even know where Kareem lives at. If he's in L.A., he didn't come across the country, you know, to do this. So it's more than a notion. So, you know, like you guys alluded to, you know, just speaks for the respect and appreciation that these guys have for my father. And then – on top of that, I didn't even know this, but Bill Russell had refused to get his ring. And once my dad got in, he tweeted, he said, Chuck Hooper is in the Hall of Fame, and he went ahead and he accepted his ring the same year. So Bill Russell and my dad got their ring the same year. And Bill was actually in the first, he would have been the first if he would have accepted, you know, when it was first offered to him, but he refused.
Wow. That's a guy that gets it. But I think we've known that for a long time, a lot of different stories, but you don't hear all the stories, to your point earlier. And now that we've laid out all those folks that were on the stage, all those Hall of Famers, and obviously they are all Hall of Famers. That's why it's not going to be younger guys. But I want to ask you about the younger guys.
Yeah.
Because when you're older, you kind of have that, you understand whose shoulders you just stood on. And I know since obviously George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, all that happened in that 4-month stretch that kind of woke up white America, for lack of a better term, but a lot of players wanted to get more involved. Do players, have they reached out? Have they connected? Do they know your dad's story? Do they understand that piece of the history? Or do they think it starts kind of with Bill Russell in the 60s?
You know, I won't call anybody out, but I can tell you I think most of the players don't really have an appreciation for these guys. And I don't necessarily think it's their fault. I mean, their stories just haven't been told. And that's one reason why I'm so glad, you know, you guys are having me on here today. But it hurts. I'll be honest with you. Like Kevin Lloyd and I'm friends with all the families now, the Lloyd family and the Clifton family. The Cleveland Cavaliers honored all three of the Pioneers back in 2016. Which connected us, so we're together now and work on some things together. But, you know, I went to the All-Star game in Chicago a couple years ago, and you know, to run into league people who work for the league and players, and have to explain, you know, like, you know, it'd be nice if you said Chuck Cooper, and they said, "Oh, your dad was that guy, right?" So I think they're hungry for the knowledge. And you know, I'm available if there's ever a way that I could, you know, help educate some of these guys and sit down and tell stories. And you know, because it's fascinating when you think about what these guys had to go through. So, you know, we're working, we'll get there. And again, I really appreciate this opportunity today to help get my father's story out and talk about some of those other guys as well.
I at least had some knowledge of who your dad was. Now, I will be honest, I don't think that the magnitude of all that they had to endure to do what they did is truly talked about in an earnest way. I mean, for you to say of your own father that his friends who were with him as he was walking history, to say that perhaps he died at the young age of 57 because of the stress of being the first, like, that is heavy.
Hey, I know my mother used to, you know, like when he was, you know, when he was working for the bank and it wasn't easy. And you know, being the first African-American city department director, that came with death threats. I remember, you know, my family shook my family, right? But my mother used to, you know, just to tell my father, like, Chuck, you got to let some of that stuff go. Like, you can't save the world. You can't take everything on by yourself. And he just really would get stressed out and not understanding why. You know, he didn't have an opportunity to, you know, run his department, the Department of Parks and Recreation, like the other directors were able to run their departments. Why do I got to go jump through extra steps, you know, to get my budget approved, right? So, you know, it was just constant battle. And he fought, and we appreciate that. And, you know, I've been blessed, you know, losing my dad at a young age. I lost my dad when I was 21. I knew that, hey, listen, with my life, I'm going to make sure that my father's story will continue to be told. And I always did that by giving back to the community. I started the Chuck Cooper, it's called the CCYDA. It was a basketball program. We used basketball as a hook to get young men and women engaged. So I was always trying to do something, give back to the community, but keep his name alive. And then back in 2009, Duquesne University, you know, came to me and they said, hey, we want to do the annual Chuck Cooper Classic basketball game. And I said, we'll do a basketball game, but I'll never do anything in my father's name that doesn't have a give back and an educational component, right? So I said, now I'll start the foundation. And we looked at doing the foundation. We said, hey, what are we going to do? What's going to be our niche? We looked at my father's history, you know, getting his master's degree after basketball was huge. And he did that because he was promised opportunity back in Pittsburgh. Oh, come on, Chuck, we got you once you retire. And they were all entry-level positions, not everything with a glass ceiling. Oh, well, you need a master's degree to become the director. Okay, fine, I'll go get a master's degree. Took family in tow, went to the University of Minnesota and got his degree. So, you know, he was always pushing the envelope and just really having appreciation for that and been blessed to be able to give scholarships to graduate students. But here's the catch. They don't just get the money. They have to give back. We have our Beacons of Light outreach program. So and our scholarship recipients are some phenomenal, highly deserving young people. We've awarded about $320,000 in scholarship support since 2013. And doesn't sound like a lot, but I started this organization after I got laid off from a pharmaceutical company from scratch without any type of guarantee that we get you on a grant or anything, right? So, but they have to give back. They have to share their stories of success, going to high school and middle schools and talk to, students coming up behind them, you know, about their amazing stories and certainly about the importance of education and just really how important it is to be good citizens if you want to be successful and accomplish things in today's society.
You mentioned your father, obviously, now the new Duquesne basketball facility is named after him in his honor, which opened last year. Beautiful new facility. His name will be carried on there. But you obviously, as you said, you started the foundation. Now, let's not sneeze in $320,000. I don't know what that says about our current higher education system. That doesn't sound like a lot of money. That's a lot of money. The problem with the education system is a different story. But in terms of, you mentioned the scholarships, you mentioned the give back part. How are you identifying people? Who are you giving the money to? Like, how does this function in terms of the foundation to grant this money? How does it work?
So being a small foundation, we're still pretty much focused in Pittsburgh. So our students who apply, some of the requirements, they have to go to a Pittsburgh area school. And that's because that give back program, we need them to be in person to do that. They have to have a 3.0 grade point average. They have to be a person of color. And they have to have already demonstrated leadership and giving back to the community.
Strong criteria. I know, Chuck, we talked a little bit about the celebrations that the league has and your experience in Chicago, but what would you like to see the league implement to really make sure that we're not missing key components of the fabric of the history of the NBA, particularly how we got to so many wonderful Black players in the NBA? But that's certainly not something that we should take for granted.
Great question. And I thank you for asking that one. What I would love to see happen is an annual basketball game or week dedicated to the early African-American pioneers, Cooper, Clifton, and Lloyd, where all the players, similar to what they do for Jackie Robinson. Now, you can argue that none of the guys individually had the impact that Jackie had. But when you put them together, you can't deny it. So, you know, where all the players from every team, you know, wear their names, maybe some type of celebratory patch that has all their names together. I know the NBA has some great graphic designers and partners. I'm sure we could come up with something. But maybe in Black History Month, where every team wears the Chuck Cooper, Earl Lloyd, Nat Sweetwater, Clifton commemorative patch on their jersey. And let that be the opportunity where we start to talk about not only their impact, but other early African-American pioneers who had impact in the NBA and even pre-NBA. Now's the time to start telling those stories because, you know, without those guys coming in and doing what they did, it would be a different league and the history would unroll much differently.
No doubt about it. Go ahead.
If this exists, forgive me, but any interest in a movie? Because of course I automatically think of like Glory Road.
I was already in my head. I'm like, how do I sell this to the right person? How do I do this? Like, I'm already there. I was gonna say, Chuck, we gotta catch up offline because I got
okay. All right.
I love the way you guys think.
I mean, I think it's just such an earnest story, you know. It's funny. And again, sorry for my sidebar, but y'all, I'm sure y'all can relate. Here in New York, you go to the 9/11 museum, you walk out that thing, it's heavy, right? Mm-hmm. At home, where I'm from, DC, the National Museum of African American History and Culture, run through the basement, it's a little emotional when you get into slavery, but other than that, it is sort of glamorous. And not that what Black people in this country have done should be celebrated, but we need to tell the whole truth. In right. contrast to that museum, you go up to Baltimore, the Blacks and Wax Museum. I'm not even sure if it's 100, if it's still open. Mm-hmm. I cried at the Blacks and Wax Museum, Chuck, yep. And you know what I mean? Yep. Like, yeah. I don't know if it's the nature of the wax or the graphic, or they didn't skip anything in terms of what it was for Black people to be brought to this country enslaved. And so, yes, while your father was an incredible basketball player and he is honored in the Naismith Hall of Fame and at Duquesne, we need to talk in earnest about all that he and those two other men that you mentioned really endured so that we could be where we are.
Yeah, there's no question about it. You know, I just think the opportunity is so great. And, you know, you talk about a movie, you know, and actually kind of goes back to what I said earlier, if it doesn't make dollars, it doesn't make sense. So I think, and a lot of, because I've spoken to some people, you know, who are definitely in the industry and could get it done if they chose to. The one thing they say is that, like, to recreate basketball scenes, you know, is like really costly. That's a costly part of the production, you know, more than the average person would think. But to me, I think, you know, just to tell the human interest side of the story, you know, we don't have to focus on the basketball scenes and that sort of thing, right? Would be incredible. Broaden it out. I mean, when you include a guy like Don Barksdale, who, again, was the first Black Olympian, you know, his story. So, you know, interesting enough, you mentioned the war earlier. And so my father and Earl Lloyd, actually, one of his seasons in college, they went, I think it was 39-0, 32-0, some crazy number when he was at West Virginia State College. My dad had went to West Virginia, was at HBUC at the time, went there, got drafted to the Navy, served his time in the Navy, then came back to Duquesne, right? The same thing happened to Earl Lloyd when he went to the NBA, his rookie season. He only played about seven games that year. He got drafted into the Army. Now, check this out. If my dad wouldn't have got drafted to the Navy, he and Earl could have been teammates at West Virginia. If they were winning, they went undefeated with just Earl, I mean, they probably could have just really set college basketball on fire if they would have got a chance to play together. And I have to mention another name who just got inducted to the Football Hall of Fame. Bill Nunn was actually my dad's high school teammate. So you got two guys that are in Hall of Fames now, one football, one basketball, and Earl Lloyd. You know, three Hall of Famers that come through one school, one small school in West Virginia is pretty special.
No doubt about it. It might have been, Texas Western is a great story in 55, winning the first, all-black team championship. You know, may have been different if those two were on the same team at West Virginia.
Never know, right?
Well, Chuck, I think it's coming. Call Ava, call the uninterrupted. Who we got to call?
It's a documentary. It's a documentary. I got some thoughts.
Let's go, man. There's so much to be celebrated and to be understood and to continue to learn. I think sometimes in larger conversations, I think we are a little bit miffed in thinking that we are driving 60 miles per hour when it comes to progress, and we still actually are at school bus zone. In many ways. And so this stuff is not beyond us at all. There's a lot there.
Well, I know you and Mr. Cuff are both well connected. So, hey, listen, anything that you guys do, share the story and make some of those phone calls. You probably have a bigger list of people in your Rolodex, than I do that are connected to the NBA that can make a difference. So please, any type of advocacy you can do to help push, the desire for people to share these guys' stories is huge. We're talking about not only black history, but we're talking about American sports history.
So absolutely.
I appreciate it.
Chuck, it's been great, man. Really, thank you for coming on the Junior NBA Coaches Podcast. Really enjoyed it. Appreciate your time and good luck going forward with the foundation and everything.
Thank you so much. I got to say, my dad's game was like Monica. He had an all-around game.
Come on, Chuck, my guy. There we go.
He had an all-around game.
I should say I was like the great Chuck Hooper.
There we go. Hey, thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. All the best.
Awesome. Thanks, Chuck.
You too.
All right. Take care. All right. Salam.
Make sure to join Monica and me for the Junior NBA Coaches Corner Podcast Nest. Check us out on juniornba.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Rate, review, subscribe, get involved. Monica, you got anything else?
Peace out. Come on back. We're just getting started. This will be another fun season.
Thanks for listening. Make sure to join Monica and Dallin each week on the Junior NBA Coaches Corner. For more, go to juniornba.com or wherever your favorite podcasts are found.